I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. A year ago, there were shocking reports that ISIS was raping and enslaving Yazidi women and girls captured in Iraq. Rukmini Kalamaki decided to follow up on those accounts and wrote about what she found in a disturbing story in the New York Times. She interviewed 21 women and girls who described being sexually assaulted by ISIS fighters who claimed it was justified by the Quran. They also described being the victims of an organized system of slavery. There have also been some disturbing stories about smart and popular teenage girls who've given up their Western lifestyle to join ISIS. What is the attraction to a group that has such a primitive and violent view of women and girls? We asked Mia Bloom to join us. She's incoming professor of communication at Georgia State University, wrote a book called Bombshell, Women and Terrorism. Mia Bloom, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And I should say to our listeners that we hope to establish contact with Rukmini Kalamaki. But in the meantime, Mia, let me begin with you. First of all, who are these young women and girls, the Yazidis in what was, I guess, northern Iraq?
So these are the Yazidi community that when ISIS expanded and was able to surround Mount Sinjar, they came under the ISIS control. And this is where we saw these heartbreaking images on the news of all the Yazidi families climbing up the mountains to try to escape being attacked and killed by ISIS. What we know from the UN that has gone in, there have been a number of investigations that there was a selection that ISIS went through, separated the men from the women, separated the young women from the older women, ranked them according to how they value them. So they valued the young women for their possibility of procreation, for selling them on the slave market. And we even have seen some videos where ISIS fighters are debating the value of a woman based on whether she has good teeth and whether she has blonde hair and blue eyes.
And how many young women, how many girls do we know have been, kidnapped by ISIS?
So according to the statistics, it's about 5,500 or 6,000 women are still missing. Several hundred have since been returned to their families, and that there's almost an underground railroad available for some of the women. So their families will seek out assistance from Yazidi men or Kurdish men who are helping get the women out. And that has actually saved a number of women and repatriated families.
Rukmini Kalamaki, it's a very disturbing story to read, but she does describe some interviews with some of these teenage girls, you know, as young as 12 and 15 year old, being frankly raped by these ISIS fighters. Also describing that before and after being sexually assaulted, these men prayed. Help us understand what that's about, Mia.
Well, ISIS has managed to distort the Islamic faith in such a way that they are justifying trafficking and sexual slavery through some very arcane surahs in the Quran, which, you know, in the same way that you can find examples of, polygamy in the Old Testament or certain things that are considered a violation or a sin in the Old Testament, we've since moved on. In many respects, the Islamic faith has moved on from some of these views about war booty. It's in the surah called Surah Al-Anfal, in which they talk about what is legitimate and what is not legitimate after Islam has conquered, you know, a city or a village. But we've gone so far past that ISIS is bringing it back, I think, because of expedience. So that they're justifying using this religious veil. And I think that's where you see the men raping the women and then praying because they think that they're divinely inspired. You know, the argument that I've heard made by Reza Aslan is that you can go to the Old Testament and find as many instances of Old Testament, chapters that abhor slavery as you could find ones that justify it. And so during the time of the abolitionists, people used the Old Testament to justify both sides of that debate. So I think that religion is being manipulated for their own, you know, dastardly purposes.
Well, let me get Rukmini Kalamaki to join our conversation. As I said, she's the author of this story that appeared in the New York Times recently about young women and girls that have been raped and become slaves of ISIS. The story entitled ISIS Enshrines a Theology of Rape. And Rukmini Kalamaki, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty, and wonderful to be here with Mia.
Well, nice to have you both with us. And Rukmini, what has been the response to your story?
It's been really touching. I've been especially moved to see that I've gotten almost as many and possibly more emails from men who describe being horrified at this as I have from women, and an outpouring of support, for the victims of these terrible crimes.
And I'm curious about what it took for these victims to be able to talk to you, to be able to talk to a journalist. I know you had a translator with you. But nonetheless, it must have taken a lot on their part to tell a stranger about what had happened to them.
I was expecting it to actually be much harder. I spent roughly 3 weeks in Iraq, going from camp to camp to see these refugee families, and the overriding theme of these conversations is that they want the world to know what is happening to the Yazidi people. They feel that they've been forgotten. They feel that there was a gush of reporting immediately after ISIS took Sinjar Mountain starting August 3rd of last year, and that there was initially a lot of concern for them. And now a year later, when roughly 3,100 Yazidis remain still enslaved by ISIS, they feel that international attention has very much dropped off.
I was talking with Mia about some of what you write about, including the fact that some of these fighters pray both before and after they rape or sexually assault these young women. Your story begins with a 12-year-old. Can you describe what she told you?
Yes, she's a 12-year-old that I met in Qadiya, which is one of the camps that was set up in the aftermath of ISIS taking over Sinjar Mountain. And I initially went in to interview her two aunts. And I was speaking to her aunts, and they were describing their own ordeals, and she was just sitting there playing, with things on the floor. And it didn't occur to me that a child this young could possibly have been a victim. And in the course of that conversation with her older relatives, we started talking about child rape. Had they witnessed any children being taken? And the aunt said, well, our 12-year-old niece was one of them. And she was sitting there in front of me, and we then began talking to her. And the thing that moved me is she's very much a child. In this part of the world, 12-year-old girls haven't even been exposed, to MTV videos. So they're very childlike. They're still playing with dolls. And I don't think she even understood, what sex is. So to her, this was just violence on her body that she didn't understand. And she described it in an almost clinical manner, just saying what he did before, what he did during, what he did after, and how many times it happened. And the chronology of everything that took place.
And how many times did it happen?
Repeatedly. And she said that the thing, I didn't put this in because I couldn't, it seemed far-fetched, but she said that he would rape her for hours and that he was taking pills. And, of course, that sounds like Viagra, but she's 12, and so I wasn't sure if that was reliable. Immediately after I interviewed her, I went on assignment to Syria for 2 weeks, and we were embedding with a militia group that is fighting ISIS. And they took us to a depot where they had recovered weapons and other accoutrements, from ISIS. And they showed us a backpack. And I asked, it was kind of a camouflage military style backpack. I asked if I could open it. They opened it for me, and all of these boxes of medicine fell out. And among the boxes of medicine were three boxes of a Turkish brand of Viagra. I took pictures of it. I took pictures of the notice inside, which said for, penile erectile dysfunction. Three boxes in just one human being's backpack.
Let me quote something that you write, and this is this young girl talking to you, and she says, "I kept telling him it hurts. Please stop," said the girl, whose body is so small an adult could circle her waist with two hands. And I underline that because I think mm-hmm. it just underscores the horror of what this young girl went through.
Yes, yes. And that, to me, is one of the darkest aspects of this, that these fighters were not only doing something that clearly harms another human being, but that they are using religion and their faith to justify it. And over, these women were told, what I am doing to you is not a sin. It's the opposite of that. In fact, it's condoned by the Quran. They would open the Quran to Surat An-Nisa, which is a chapter in the Quran that talks about slavery, and say, and then kind of make the extra leap, that because it's in the Quran and because it's in stories of the life of the Prophet Muhammad, it is therefore not just legal, it's spiritually beneficial, even virtuous, to be doing this to another person.
Mia Bloom, let me go back to you. Has or is ISIS a place where pedophiles and sadists can go and be accepted?
I mean, they are making that distinction. I see them as pedophiles, but they've created this justification, ex post facto justification for basically abusing children sexually. And this is not the first instance we've seen of the abuse of children. We know, for example, with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, raping little boys, there is this tradition called Bachabalzi, which again is a Pashtun tradition. So the idea of the children and the little girls in many ways being commoditized is something that we've seen with many of these jihadi groups going back to the 1980s. And in fact, although the Taliban initially fought against the Bachabazi, fought against raping little boys, as we've seen in ensuing years, they adopted the practice as well. So it became a metric of success. And so what we see in Afghanistan with the little boys and with ISIS with these very young girls is that it's one of the ways in which the fighters are demonstrating their success and their wealth. It's just one additional metric. So they'll have a jihadi bride, but they'll also have access to a number of these Yazidi sex slaves. And it's one of the ways in which ISIS has been recruiting, not just from the local areas, you know, from the Middle East, from the Gulf, from North Africa, but also it might be one of the lures to bring in foreign fighters from places like the UK, Australia, and Canada.
Well, I do want to pick up on that. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and then we do need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mia Bloom. She's an incoming professor of communication at Georgia State University. Wrote a book called Bombshell, Women and Terrorism. Also with us is Rukmini Kalamaki, and she's a foreign correspondent for The New York Times, has been covering Islamic extremism, wrote a very disturbing and very important story in The Times titled ISIS Enshrines the Theology of Rape. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're talking about how ISIS uses theology to justify rape and sex slavery, talking with Mia Bloom and Rukmini Kalamaki. Rukmini, if I can go back to you, and Mia talked about young boys in Afghanistan. Are young Yazidi boys also the targets of rape and sexual assault in from your reporting?
No, not that I found. The Yazidi boys, the young boys, are essentially separated from their mothers and taken to jihadi training camps. And that's another aspect of this that I did not have the time to get into, but it's also quite dark. They are essentially trying to turn the children of this ethnic minority into a weapon against them. They are being trained as suicide bombers. They are being trained as militants. I went to one household where a three-year-old child had just escaped with his mother. The child had been brutally beaten by the slave owner in the house where he was, forced to read the Quran, forced to memorize the Quran, and forced to pray. And I met him, I think, 3 months after he had escaped,
And the parents were telling me, and were deeply traumatized by this, that their child keeps on waking up at dawn and trying to wake up the entire family to force them to pray. This is a family that is not Muslim. When he sees the sun going down, he tries to get his father to kneel on the floor and go through the ritual of Muslim prayer. So they're brainwashing them and trying to enforce this ideology and this strict religiosity on a group of people that are not from this religion.
Mia, you wrote about this in Foreign Affairs recently, an article titled Cubs of the Caliphate, where you describe how these children are enticed and indoctrinated. They witness things like public executions and eventually get drawn into terrorism, the world of terrorism.
Well, yes, and so the Yazidi boys are being groomed in this way, very coercively. The article also discussed the way in which ISIS was luring through what I would consider to be positive inducements, young Syrian children. And so there is a variety of children that are basically going to form the next generation. And this is one of ISIS's deliberate tactics, is that they see themselves as building a new society, a new state, and so what they're doing is they're preparing that next generation. But one of the things that we need to consider is the fact that any terrorist group that starts training children at such a young age, in part, is inoculating itself against attacks or targeted assassinations or drones, because very quickly the children can step into the adult's shoes. What we've seen is this very slow, gradual progression where children first either see videos of executions, then they attend live executions. More recently, videos have emerged where the children are distributing knives for the executions. And in July, mid-July, the final video was released where a child actually beheaded the prisoner himself and, you know, then held the head up by the hair, you know, in triumph to show that he had managed to cut the head off. So it's obscenity beyond the description that I can provide, but it's like almost a Game of Thrones for them, where it doesn't even look real anymore because it's so routine.
Rukmini, I want to go back to your article, and I have to say, as I read through it, and this is describing the system of slavery that ISIS is installing in the territory that it controls. And it reminds me of Auschwitz. I was there last fall. And what the Nazis did, this was very organized. They had contracts. There's a bureaucracy. And as you described in this New York Times article, it has some of those same features.
The thing that surprised me when I came here to do the story is I expected to find, you know, stories of mass rape. What I did not expect to find is an organization behind it, an infrastructure of systematic rape. And from the very beginning, what we saw is that on August 3rd of last year, every single person that I interviewed, and I interviewed 21 women and girls who survived this ordeal, every single one of them said that within the first hour, women and men were separated from each other, and women were then placed in empty trucks and in fleets of buses, empty buses that had been brought to essentially carry them away. That, to me and to them, suggests that this was pre-planned. And in fact, in their flagship magazine, The Beak, in October of last year, ISIS said as much. They talked about how they had consulted Islamic scholars and talked about the status of Yazidi people and determined that they are people that can be enslaved. The fact that the conquest of this territory was not just for territorial gain, but essentially a sexual conquest, it points to something, you know, very twisted, that they thought of this, that they prepared for it, that they planned for it, and that they then instituted this system of organized slavery.
And you, Mia, have written about the fact that ISIS sees this as a way to solve its quote-unquote marriage crisis, is that it says to these male recruits, we have a bride or perhaps a young girl for you.
Right. And so it's one of the ways in which I've been explaining that women have been commoditized. What I found upsetting is that, you know, say on social media or on Twitter or Facebook, when you talk about this, you have the ISIS fanboys going, oh, well, that's just the Yazidi community. They don't see them in the same light as, you know, other Muslims. But when I talked about it, they're also commoditizing Sunni women.
And that's where it starts to spark maybe a certain amount of outrage, because in as much as you have the Yazidi women who are sex slaves, and it is, as Rukmini has stated, a systematic and bureaucratized form of sponsored rape, you also have women who are being commoditized, who are being brought in, very young girls, 15 and 16, like the Bethnal Green girls from the UK, who are lured in, and then right away, they are also commoditized. They are gifted to the fighters based on the fighters' ranking. We know that from people who live in the region, the foreign fighters get the first choice of bribes. They get the first choice of Yazidi sex slaves. And so it's really an environment in which women are a proxy for wealth, and it's a boondoggle. Mm-hmm. So when I say it's when I said that it's a resolved marriage crisis, not so much the Yazidi community, but the fact that they're getting hundreds upon hundreds of European women who are going, or women who are coming from North America, Australia, Indonesia, that these women are being lured in, and they are the ones that are helping resolve the marriage crisis.
And I do want to pick up on that. To you, Rukmini, we have an email from WM, wants to know, please discuss how these girls and women are accepted or not accepted back in their families. You interviewed a number of 21 of them who were able to escape or were helped to escape from the clutches of ISIS. Mm-hmm. Were they accepted back in their families, in their community?
You know, I saw something very heartening when I went to these refugee camps to speak to these women. Unlike in other places, in other parts of the world where I've covered rape and where women are systematically shamed and essentially you know pushed out of their communities, I think that this event is so widespread. So many women have been affected that element of shame has sort of been removed. The spiritual leader of the Yazidi community, Baba Sheikh, he has twice now come out and made statements to the effect that these women need to be reintegrated into the community and that they should not be blamed for what happened. And among the more touching things that I saw is a group of Yazidi male activists. They went on Facebook, they created a group, and they've been posting on Facebook that they support these women and that they are willing individually to marry these women to make a point, you know, that they do not consider this to be to have tainted them in any way. So I actually saw women that were women and girls that are being reintegrated quite well.
I'm curious, Rukmini, why target the Yazidis? I mean, there are other Muslims in this part of the world. They're Christians, they're Jews as well. Why the Yazidis?
Initially, they thought that the Yazidis are not Muslims. They are seen as being polytheists because they believe in seven sacred angels. For that reason, they fall out of every single category that might have some level of protection within Islamic scripture. By contrast, Christians and Jews, who are referred to as people of the book because they have a written scripture, have some limited protections in the Quran. For example, they are allowed to pay a tax called the jizya, and if they pay this tax and agree to live as essentially second-class citizens in a Muslim land, they can be allowed to live. So we initially thought that this is why the Yazidis are being targeted in this manner and that this is why we are not seeing a systematic case of Christian women being victimized, and we know that they are holding hundreds of Assyrian Christians as we speak. What's confusing, though, Margie, is that last month, the Islamic State began circulating on Twitter a lengthy manual on sexual slavery, which the New York Times was able to translate, 37 pages, I think. And in that manual, they make very clear that the Yazidis, as well as Christians, can be targeted. So we don't completely understand why it is that the Yazidis have been facing the brunt of this.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Rukmini Kalamaki, a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, has been covering Islamic extremism. Her story, ISIS Enshrines a Theology of Rape, was published last week in the Times. She's a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, has won a number of journalistic awards, including the Michael Kelly Award. Also with us is Mia Bloom, and she's incoming professor of communication at Georgia State University, has written several books, including Bombshell, Women and Terrorism. Feminism, Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. She's got a forthcoming book written with John Horgan to be titled Small Arms, Children and Terror. And we are talking about what Rukmini Kalamaki has been writing about in the New York Times, and also some of the work that Mia Bloom has been doing as well, looking at how women have been targeted in the Middle East by ISIS, and also how women have been recruited from other parts of the world. 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments to join our conversation? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments for our guest? Mia, let me go back to you. And I'm actually looking at a story that was also in the New York Times. Young Mississippi couple linked to ISIS perplexing all. And this is about a young woman and a young man from America, from Mississippi. And I want to focus just on the young woman. She's an honor student. She was clearly a popular student at her school. Why does ISIS target someone like that? You'd think they would not be interested in what ISIS has to offer.
Well, you know, we've seen a number, a very small number, thankfully, of American women, starting, I think, early. Shannon Maureen Connolly from Denver, who was online with an ISIS fighter. The ISIS fighter got her father's permission to marry her. And in Denver, she got on a flight, or tried to get on a flight, and was arrested at the airport. So we've seen a number of women in the United States targeted. A lot of these women are divided into two categories. The younger women are very high-achieving. Many of them are straight-A students. They're quite young. Versus some of the older women who are, some of them are converts, or some of them have had some very checkered past. And so both in their conversion as well as joining ISIS, they're able to reinvent themselves. So ISIS has cast a very wide net to try to get as many women as possible. They haven't been as successful in the United States as they have in places like France and in the UK, where it's reached a really troubling proportion. But Misty Young in Alabama is one such example of, you know, you have someone who sees this as an exciting adventure, that they are believing ISIS propaganda, that they've created this utopian society of equality. What she doesn't see is the kinds of videos I mentioned earlier on, where the men are haggling over the Yazidi sex slave, saying things like, the whiter the better. Because I don't think that had Ms. Young seen that video, she would have necessarily thought that as an African-American woman, she was going to be treated especially well by ISIS. And we've seen this kind of thing happening over and over again, where they are privileging light skin, blonde hair, blue eyes. It is really a quite unsettling scenario.
But I'm curious, Mia, what is the pitch that ISIS makes? And again, this is to an 18, 19-year-old girl in Mississippi. She was a cheerleader, an honor student, the daughter of a police officer in her town. What's the pitch?
The pitch is, you know, come here, you're going to have this opportunity to demonstrate your altruism. Like, one of the things that ISIS always tells young girls, and this was true of the Bethnal Green girls who disappeared from the UK in February, you want to help Syrian children. You don't need to look at ISIS propaganda to be outraged by what Bashar al-Assad is doing to Syrian children using barrel bombs. So one of the pitches that they sort of harp on this idea that by going and joining ISIS, you're making this wonderful contribution to a good cause. They also present themselves in this utopian society, that they are a great place where you can be a Muslim, not be discriminated against. You'll have all these opportunities. But I think that for me, what was telling is that what ISIS says in English is very different from what it says in Arabic. So, for example, they put together a pamphlet only in Arabic that Charlie Winter translated from Quillian Foundation in February. And it basically in Arabic says, you're not going to have an exciting life. You're going to be, in all likelihood, married off within 3 months. You're expected to have lots of children immediately, and you may not even be able to leave the house. And I think that if American women or British women, French women read that pamphlet, they might have a very different impression of ISIS than what's being said to these young women and girls in English, French, or in 25 different languages that ISIS is tweeting in.
Rukmini, do you want to add anything to what Tamia just said there?
I think the the other element that we're missing when we see, you know, when we see a young person like this young woman who almost went to join ISIS, is we're missing the human effort that goes into recruiting these young people. Earlier this year, I did a longer story about a young woman in Washington State from a rural part of Washington. She lives in a trailer with her grandparents, and she was a Sunday school teacher. And they succeeded in a period of months of taking her from being a Sunday school teacher and a young woman who has gospel verses, you know, all over her house, from that place to converting to Islam, and then very soon after to starting to discuss the logistics of her marrying a good Muslim man, as they called him, etc. And it doesn't, you know, when you just hear that, it doesn't make any sense. But when I went to meet this young woman who wanted to be referred by her nickname, Alex, what I realized is that the recruiter was essentially spending 8, 9, 10 hours a day with her on Skype, in text messages, in emails, and if you look at the communications, it's extremely loving, you know, very affectionate, very kind. You know, every day he's asking, how are you? How's your grandmother? If she's had a fight with her grandparents, he's providing advice. If she's out planting, working in her garden, he's giving her gardening tips. And so it's almost like a boyfriend relationship, these recruiters. And I think I hate to say it, but I think it's quite flattering to these people. And they let themselves get carried away. And at a certain point, they sort of suspend, you know, the logical part of their brain and begin believing what this person is telling them about the Islamic State.
And hold on to that thought, only because we have to take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Rukmini Kalamaki, a foreign correspondent for The New York Times, wrote a story last week, ISIS Enshrines a Theology of Rape. Also with us, Mia Bloom is the author of a book called Bombshell, Women and Terrorism, and we are talking about how ISIS recruits and enslaves women. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Rukmini Kalamaki and Mia Bloom about ISIS, a story that Rukmini had in the New York Times recently, ISIS Enshrines a Theology of Rape. Also, Mia Bloom has written about women and terrorism and ISIS, and we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'll be reading some emails in just a moment or two, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mia, thinking of what Rukmini said right before the break about how ISIS spent hours recruiting one, you know, individual woman in the western part of the United States, how does the U.S., how do others that want to take on ISIS, how do you counter these recruiting efforts?
I mean, part of what we need to do is to make, you know, they say that it's important that we make terrorism known. You know, we can't assume that, for example, looking at the social media or the tweets by some notable women in ISIS is a reflection of the reality. So we need to dig deeper. And I think that Rukmini's story demonstrates that there are these young women who are desperately lonely, in need of attention. And ISIS is portraying itself as a mechanism of, you know, you want to do great things with your life. That's where you need to come to the caliphate. And that has been a consistent message. And so they capitalize on, you know, genuine feelings of wanting to help, do good. They've been approaching women who are doctors or in nursing schools around the globe in places like Indonesia and Pakistan because they realize, first of all, the women need medical attention, especially since they've been encouraging this new generation and they've been giving additional monthly supplements for every child born in the caliphate. And so as a result, they've been deliberately looking for, professionals, white-collar engineers, doctors, nurses. They need these people because the kind of education that they're providing the generation in these Quran schools that they run isn't giving them mathematics and sciences. They're giving them indoctrination, ideology, some interpretation of the Quran that they believe in, and then physical training. But they're not training the children to be the next generation of engineers. And so that's where they're so heavily dependent on the foreign fighters to keep that steady stream. That's where all that intense person-to-person tweeting and social media and Facebook. And if I'm not mistaken, I think in this particular case, the gentleman might have even not been in Syria. I think he might have even been in the UK still. And so they have their fanboys representing and helping them.
Well, I mean, it sounds like they're, and Rukmini, I'll get to you in just a second, but it sounds like what you're saying, Mia, is that they're targeting, in some cases, professional women with the idea that they will, what, educate the next generation of ISIS fighters, but also living under this really extreme and very backward culture or society. Sort of doesn't make any sense.
It's not so much that the women will educate, but that the women will make a contribution that, oh, you're a doctor in Birmingham? Yes, but if you come to Raqqa, you could really do something. Oh, are you a nurse in Peshawar? Oh, you could really do something if you're here. And it capitalizes on very good people's intention to help rather than a different message that they were initially starting with. Oh, here's your real life call of duty. You want to kill people? Come to ISIS. Right. Those are very different messages. Right?
Yeah, go ahead, Rukmini.
Yeah, and I think Mia is exactly right. What struck me about this young woman in Washington State is she's a genuinely sweet and kind person. I mean, she her heart bleeds when she sees these images of children being killed in barrel bombs, atrocities, etc. And so in a way it's actually a very odd fit because in order to be able to get to the point where she's being recruited by the Islamic State, she has to willfully ignore all of the beheading videos, all of the other atrocities that ISIS is perpetrating. But they manage to kind of position them and lure them in through kindness and through enormous attention and get them to a place where they actually feel that this is the place. This is if I go to Raqqa, this is where I can make a difference and where I can, you know, I can put my ideals to good use.
Rukmini, we have an email from Bern who says, is the kidnapping and raping of ISIS correlated with the abduction of hundreds of schoolgirls by Boko Haram? Is there a connection there?
I think there is. When Boko...
Yeah, go ahead, Rukmini, and then I'll give you a chance, Mia. But go ahead, Rukmini. That's okay.
Keep in mind that Boko Haram is now an official arm of ISIS. It's their West Africa province now. Back when they took the Chibok girls last year, these are roughly 300 girls that were taken from the village of Chibok. Back then, Boko Haram was still sort of on the fence. They were a group that was actively trying to petition Al-Qaeda to become an arm of Al-Qaeda. And at the same time, they were starting to gravitate towards ISIS. And it's my opinion that the Chibok girl kidnapping was sort of a line in the sand because Al-Qaeda leaders, especially within AQAP, the branch in Yemen, they came out and pretty strongly stated that taking these girls is against Sharia and it's against their ideals and that they don't stand by that. Boko Haram held on to the girls and not long after, ISIS put out an article in one of the issues of The Beak, their English language magazine, essentially condoning what they had done. And that, I believe, was the beginning of the ISIS-Boko Haram merger. They're essentially doing the same thing. They're pointing to, you know, a few select verses inside in the Quran and then the tradition of the Sunnah, which is the sayings and the life of the Prophet Muhammad, and using those isolated pieces of scripture to justify sexual slavery.
Mia, go ahead. Do we have Mia? Did we lose her?
No, I'm here. Sorry.
Okay. Oh, it sounded like you wanted to say something. No, go ahead, Mia.
Yeah, I just finished a study that will be published in a few months where we looked at women in Boko Haram. What we've seen is that in some same ways, women were distributed to the fighters as gifts. Women were raped multiple times repeatedly. And many of the women who were then sexually abused, at a certain point, they were then turned into suicide bombers, very much against their will. Some of the girls as young as 7 years old. So in that respect, Boko Haram is treating women very similarly as ISIS. They're both gifting the women. but they've weaponized the women. And so that's where the difference is. They've turned women into suicide bombers, and so there have been over 54 instances in the last 13 months where women have been suicide bombers, targeting specifically civilian targets like Madagori Market, the chicken market, or the cell phone market, because women are blending in with the civilian population, and they're less likely to be invasively searched. But the other thing we've seen is that in addition to the 276 women who or girls that were kidnapped at Chibok, there was an additional 1,400 women kidnapped all over the country, including Muslim women and Christian women, and they don't differentiate. Mm-hmm. And like ISIS, they're raping them, they're praying. They're praying that the women get pregnant so that they will give birth also to Boko Haram fighters.
Let me read a part of an email from Susan. She says, unless we let this play out and Muslim armies from Muslim countries take action and fight these interpretations of Islam, there will always be movements to try this orthodox approach. Western intervention will never be able to quell these interpretations of Islam. Rukmini, I'd be just curious about what you say in response to Susan's comments there.
Well, I think it bears pointing out that right now the effort to push back ISIS, both in Iraq and in Syria, is being done by essentially proxy forces. I was just in Syria, and the main group that is making gains against the Islamic State is a Kurdish militia known as the YPG. It is getting support from the United States, including air support, but it's them that is doing the fighting. In Iraq, you have the Peshmerga, and you also have the Iraqi army, and you have Shiite militias. So far, the West has been pretty disciplined about not putting boots on the ground. Mm. I think because they understand that that is exactly what ISIS wants. The Beak, which is the name of their main publication, and it's also the name of a small town in northern Syria that they now control, refers to a very famous battle in Islamic scripture where the Crusaders, which is us, were defeated by Islamic armies. And so this is the prophecy that they are waiting for. They want us to go in and you know, go face to face with them, and so I think in contrast to what your to what your listener is saying, I think that right now the fight is not being fought by, you know, by Western armies, and I have to think that that's a good thing for now.
Well, Mia, I'd be curious about your response as well. And I have to say, especially reading Rukmini's article and reading other articles about the fate of these Muslim, these young women and these girls, these teenagers, also knowing, of course, that Yazidi men have been murdered by ISIS. So we shouldn't forget about that either. But just the sort of frustration of sitting on the side, knowing what these young people are going through is very, very disturbing, I have to say.
I mean, I think it's definitely disturbing. And I think some of the challenges is that the different participants in the conflict in the Middle East make for very strange bedfellows. So on the one hand, the Kurdish forces are at the forefront of pushing ISIS out of Kobani and providing a resistance, including some all-female brigades who've been fantastic in fighting what they call Daesh. It's a negative way of saying ISIS. But while the Kurds have been fighting as proxies, helping the situation, the Turkish government has also been strafing Kurdish forces. So the Turkish government has this very complicated situation of not wanting to support the Kurds for fear how that will reverberate back in Turkey with Kurdish independence movements. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there is a discussion in this country about the Iran nuclear deal. Iranian forces are also fighting ISIS in Iraq. And so the question then becomes, you know, as we find ourselves in this complex international alliance, are we getting into bed with, on the one hand, Kurdish forces, which are still technically listed as a foreign terrorist organization, and Iranian forces, who at least half of the Senate is opposed to? It's really complicated. So it does make for a very messy situation where there's no easy solutions and no easy answers.
Well, let me get a caller, Jeff, calling us from Hokas in Delaware to join the conversation. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. This is for your two guests. I would like to know how you feel that the President of the United States is, called ISIS the JV team, and then adamantly says they're not Islamic and refuses to call Islamic terrorism what it is, Islamic terrorism. I'll take my answer off the air.
Sure, Jeff. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mia, do you want to weigh in on that?
I understand what the caller is asking. Jeff, so on the one hand, if you look at the actual numerical force of ISIS, you're looking at maybe 30 or 40,000 people. And in fact, it's not representative of the areas. It's drawing a lot of foreign fighters. It's drawing a handful of Sunnis. But they're operating in places where if they took control of Aleppo, they'd be in trouble because they'd have a lot of Alawi and Shia populations, and they don't have the manpower. So as far as them being a JV team, they're not the kind of threat that, you know, is an existential threat to the United States. They're very threatening to the local actors. They're very threatening to the countries of the Middle East, especially as those fighters return home, as they did after Afghanistan and Chechnya and Bosnia. And they can do a lot of damage locally. But I think what the president was trying to convey is that as far as an existential threat to the United States, it's not really threatening to us. The part that is really upsetting is the fact that they've killed a number of Western hostages in the most obscene and graphic way. And I think that that's why we see them as a greater threat. They're projecting that threat. And as far as them being Islamic or un-Islamic, I think over 150 different Islamic scholars have come out against ISIS. And so looking at what ISIS does is extremely un-Islamic, in part because they are abusing people of the book. They're forcing people to convert, which is against the Quran. And they're also doing things in ways which the Islamic faith has moved away from. So I think that this is where this whole debate comes in, and you've got a lot of people who chime in about it.
And Rukmini, we're almost out of time here, and I'm just curious, looking ahead, will you be continuing to cover this story of the Yazidi girls and women?
I'd like to. I mean, I think that what we're seeing with the Yazidi community is essentially ethnic cleansing. The UN has called it as much. And it bears noting that the Yazidi ethnic group is very small. Community leaders estimate that there are only around 500,000 Yazidis total in Iraq. Pretty much every single one of them has been displaced from their homes around Sinjar Mountain. And there's an enormous exodus of Yazidis seeking exit visas. They're leaving in large numbers to go to Germany. Many are getting a visa to go to the U.S. So we're seeing essentially the destruction of a people who have been here for a very long time.
Amir, we're almost out of time here. Something that you wrote about the divisions within ISIS. Do you think that could be ISIS's undoing?
I think we're already starting to see some of these chasms emerge. We know that there's a difference between these Muhajirun, the foreign fighters, and the Ansar, the local Syrians. The local Syrians are really irritated by the fact that the foreign fighters get the first choice of everything. They get the more money. They get paid in U.S. dollars and not in Syrian dinar. And so as a result, because of inflation, the standard of living for the foreign fighters is greater. And so one of the things that I was thinking of writing about with a scholar of Islam is to say that this is genuinely turning on its head the way war booty has traditionally been distributed, that the Arabs get more and they get first versus the foreigners. What ISIS is doing is absolutely the reverse of the tradition, so that they're un-Islamic on so many different levels. And I think that the conversation needs to continue, that this will be the end of them. That they are not beloved.
And we have to end our conversation. Mia Bloom, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And Rukmini Kalamaki, thank you very much as well.
Thank you to you and thank you to Mia.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.